KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Coming up in this hour of Forum, we'll split the hour. We'll talk first to former San Francisco Chronicle religion writer Don Latin and then with former Bay Area-based photographer Howard Schatz. Forum is next. Join us after this. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Good morning and welcome to this morning's Forum. Joining us for the first half hour of this hour of Forum is award-winning journalist Don Latin, who for many years wrote about religion for the San Francisco Chronicle. Why are we doing so much on religion here? It's coincidental that it works out that way, and I don't want anybody to be offended by the fact that we're doing a segment with Don now, who's the author of a book called Jesus Freaks, certainly out of respect for those of you who were on the side of the Christian conservatives in the last hour. No offense is obviously intended here. Don is also the author of Following Our Bliss, How the Spiritual Ideals of the 60s Shape Our Lives Today, and he's co-author of Shopping for Faith, American Religion in the New Millennium. Teaches religion writing at the Graduate School of Journalism at UC Berkeley and lives here in the Bay Area. And his newest book is called Jesus Freaks, A True Story of Murder and Madness on the Evangelical Edge. And it's the story of a brutal crime that took place in January of 2005 and cast a good deal of light on a group known as the Children of God or the Family International. The leader was a charismatic figure and a visionary of the apocalypse named David Brandt Berg. And first of all, Don, welcome to the program here.
Thank you, Michael.
This is a pretty sensational story. I mean, it suggests that you're a sensationalist writer or anything, but you've got all those elements of incest and prostitution and apocalypse and murder. And anybody who wants to read this story will read a gripping and a extraordinary, in many ways, story. I want to talk with you, though, about all the children that were raised in this cult, really, is mm-hmm. what it was, the mm-hmm. Children of God or the family. Right. 13,000 children.
Yes.
And what happens to the children who grow up in a religious cult of this sort? So what do we know about them?
Yeah, well, when people hear that number, 13,000 children, they think, how can that be? But you have to remember there were thousands of people and thousands of women in this group in the heyday, and they had very large families. So they're out there. And this is not just about the Children of God. I mean, there are children in a lot of other new religious movements or even political movements, all kinds of authoritarian groups that are having trouble.
But this group had a lot of sex abuse of children, which is prompting...
It did. And the sex abuse in this group was different. Of course, we've had sex abuse in the Catholic Church with the pedophile priest scandal. We've had it in the Hare Krishnas. But here, it was almost a matter of doctrine. They were preaching. They didn't consider it abuse. They considered it love. But they were actually preaching that this was acceptable. It wasn't just a question of sexual abuse, though, for these children. There was the main character I read about in the book, Ricky Davidito Rodriguez, who was raised to be the new prophet of the Children of God. I mean, he said the spiritual abuse was worse than the sexual abuse. So there are all kinds of abuse that went on.
He was
in this
figure
group.
In the murder that you write about.
Yes, course, yes.
The story here. But thousands of them defected and tried to lead normal lives. How able are they to do that in the final analysis, that is, lead normal lives?
Yeah, we have to remember that these kids they didn't join this cult like their parents did. They had no choice in this matter. They were born into this, and they were raised with extreme religious indoctrination. They memorized the Bible. I mean, they considered themselves a Christian group, but they also had to memorize the writings of Berg, and all their educational materials were based around Berg's ideas. David Berg, the founder of the group.
They're Moses, as it were.
Yeah, his nickname was Mo for Moses. And to leave a group like this is so difficult because their whole worldview, their whole life, their family, is all based around this group, and it's almost like going to another planet when you leave a group like this, these totalist groups where you just have no idea how to operate in the world, how to get a driver's license, how to get a checkbook. You know, these kids had all these viscerally practical problems, but also they were estranged from their family, everyone they knew. You know, it's much like these kids we've been reading about in the Mormon sects in Utah, the fundamentalist Mormon, polygamous Mormon groups, the boys who were kicked out of those groups, that how trouble they have making it.
It's like a lot of the cults, really. I mean, in terms of how difficult it is to move from that world into the world at large, it becomes for many of them, like you said, going on another planet almost. So what do we know along these lines about the kids who have this kind of mind-forged, manacled background, to use Blake's phrase?
Yeah. Well, you know, I think it's important to look at not just the problem these kids had, because those problems are there, but I think there's some broader lessons to learn, you know, in this story. I mean, I think it's a cautionary tale in a lot of ways about what happens when someone follows a self-proclaimed prophet, when someone follows someone else who thinks they know who speaks for God, rather than your own conscience.
Like and Pat
your
Robertson, own under- we spoke about it the last hour, I guess.
Exactly. They were saying how, in last hour, you were saying how evangelicals don't follow what people say. Well, some do, you know. I mean, in these Christian sects, what separates them from mainstream evangelicalism is the power they put in individual prophets. And these are not just, I mean, there are some TV evangelists you could put on this list I'm talking about. Maybe they're not sexually exploiting people, but they're financially exploiting people. And the other thing that's interesting with the Children of God is he started out, as you mentioned in the opening, as an apocalyptic prophet. He called himself the end time prophet. Well, this is the same apocalyptic scenario that's preached by so many other evangelicals today. The end of the world is coming. You know, the churches are corrupt. And, you know, there's nothing like the end of the world to motivate the troops and the fear that's coming. And that happens in mainstream evangelicalism today, and it happened to an extreme amount in David Berg and the Children of God.
And the Children of God were right out of evangelical tradition, as you point out in your book.
Yeah, I mean, Christianity Today, which is a very highly respected, by myself included, magazine of evangelicalism, founded originally by Billy Graham, they, right in the first, when the Galleys first came out, the editor, you know, sent out a blog taking issue at the title of the book. The first line of the introduction is, some Christians might take issue with the title of this book. And his blog started out, Don Latin is right. I do take issue with the title of this book. But I think if people read the first chapter or two, they'll see that, I mean, David Berg came right out of the evangelical Christian tradition. His mother, Virginia Brant Berg, was a famous evangelist in the school of Emmy Semple McPherson, had a huge church in Miami, was one of the first women radio evangelists. Berg learned right at her apron strings how to do this. His grandfather was a famous evangelist. And if you look today at the Family International, which is what this group is called today, you look at their website, their statement of beliefs, they appear to be a evangelical Christian group according to their beliefs. Now, they have some strange beliefs still. But their mainstream doctrine is evangelical Christianity, no doubt about it.
So the cautionary tale part of this is the authoritarianism mm-hmm. from, you know, a leader who is given a kind of absolute belief, and also the sense of maybe believing the apocalypse is nigh.
Yeah, and of course Christians have been believing this for 2,000 years, but not like now. I mean, it's hard for us to realize how since say
well, not
this,
like the millennium. We came on the millennium.
Yeah, well, it was really in the '60s, really, that this feeling really started with the book by Hal Lindsey, The Late Great Planet Earth, which was the best-selling book of the '70s. Now you've got this Left Behind series of apocalyptic fiction, which have sold 65 million copies in the last 10 years. I mean, you and I, with books out, we drool when we see those numbers.
Yeah. I don't know, Stephen Colbert near those numbers.
Yeah. but anyway, I mean, this kind of thinking, this apocalyptic end time thinking, is very prominent in the culture. And Ricky was a character in Berg's apocalyptic fantasy, and it was the same fantasy that you read about in Left Behind.
Talking to Don Latin, and again, the book is called Jesus Freaks, A True Story of Murder and Madness on the Evangelical Edge. I'm going to open the phone lines now because Don's going to be with us until the half hour, after which we're going to talk with photographer Howard Schott. So if you'd like to join this conversation, you can do so now, whether you're listening to us on radio, internet, or Sirius satellite. Our toll-free number is 866-733-7255. 6786, and feel free to join the program now. Lines are open and available to you if you have something you'd like to contribute. Again, you're welcome to do that at our toll-free number, 866-733-6786, or you can join us by email. The email address here is forum@kqed.org. What drew you to this story?
Well, I've been writing about cults, sects, new religious movements, depending on your point of view, since the 70s. And in the 90s, I started writing about children who grew up in these groups, not just this group, but three or four other groups, which I wrote a series for the Chronicle in 2001. And that's really where it began. So I had a lot of context. I knew people in this group. So when the child prophet left and went postal and committed this incredibly brutal crime, I was the first to hear about it in the media and broke the story. But I hadn't really...
Can you just talk about that? I mean, exactly what happened?
Yeah. What happened is the main character in this book is named Ricky Davidito Rodriguez, and he was born to... He's the only son of the woman who now leads this group, Karen Zerbe, known as Maria in the group. He was the first child born to the strangest evangelical technique I've ever heard of, which was something called flirty fishing, where Jesus said, "Go ye forth and be fishers of men." Well, David Berg sent young, attractive women out into bars, nightclubs, all over the world to seduce men to follow Christ and also to join his cult. And they would, if necessary, they would sleep with these men to convince them to join, that this is God's love you're experiencing here. And Ricky was the first child born to flirty fishing. And there were hundreds, at least hundreds more born in that particular, maybe thousands born through in that period. The women were not allowed to use birth control. These sacred prostitutes were not allowed to use birth control because that was immoral. And so the babies they didn't know who the father was, who would run off, they'd call them Jesus babies. I mean, this is some pretty strange stuff going on, but this actually happened. So Ricky was born in this environment. There was a lot of sexual abuse, very free attitude towards sexuality in the group when he was growing up. And basically as an adult, he left, he renounced the group and was so frustrated that none of these people were being brought to justice for all this abuse, including the sexual abuse, that he decided the only thing he could do would go on a rampage and get revenge, kind of become the martyr he was always expected to be, except this time it was a self-fulfilling prophecy, but with this twist. Rather than being the end times prophet battling the forces of evil, he went back and was battling what he saw as the forces of evil, which was his church that he grew up in. So he's a tragic figure because he could never escape his destiny. You know, and there's so many other of the girls are like that too who grew up in this group.
It's a story that's emblematic of these extremes and excesses, isn't it?
Yeah, but it's also a cautionary tale about how could Berg get so popular and what was the secret to his success? He was just at the right place at the right time. I mean, in the late 60s,
was the Branch Davidian guy. I mean, a lot of these stories
but in Berg's case, he combined the counterculture, the sexual revolution with the beginnings of this evangelical revival we're seeing now. And they were one of the so-called Jesus people, the Jesus freaks. You know, these were hippies.
It's sort of like Charles Manson, but without the Beatle lyrics.
Yeah,
instead it's the Bible.
No, it was like Jesus Christ Superstar and Godspell, and those things came out of that movement. Yeah.
Well, let's bring our listeners in. Andrea, good morning.
Good morning. Now that the media spotlight is on the family, they probably have really toned down the sexual abuse and the spiritual abuse. But I wonder about current family children. If the end time is near, then isn't the philosophy of the past of why bother to educate, why bother to give medical care to the children still going on? Because I think it is. They're still not bothering to educate their children or take care of them and give them proper medical care. What do you think?
Yeah, I think that the hardcore sexual abuse has ended for the most part. You're still going to have isolated examples of it. And you're right. They're not given an education in the mainstream sense of the word, but there's other kinds of spiritual abuse. These kids are really indoctrinated into this mindset. Now you can say, well, a lot of parents do that with their kids. We call it religious education, but it raises a lot of interesting points. But what's the line between religious education and religious indoctrination? I mean, can you teach children anything? and a lot of these kids are very messed up because of that. And also, while they're not encouraging sex between adults and minors, they still practice what they call the law of love. And there's sexual sharing among the adult members in the group, often widely varying ages. And so the children see that. So some might say that's abuse.
There's a legacy, I mean, for these kids. And it goes on. In fact, I think some of the research suggests it's transgenerational beyond even the children. It goes on to the next generation.
Yes, yes. Yeah.
Let me thank Andrea for her call and go to another caller in Berkeley. Vivienne, good morning.
And my opinion is that, you know, Karl Marx said that the religion is the opium of people. And throughout history, all the churches, all they have done is to create a separation between the concept of God and a human. We are God. God is not outside of us. But as long as the church continues to separate that and to give fear to the people, they feed them with fear. Like the end is coming. The end is always here. We are born to die. That's the end. But as long as the church continues to manipulate the minds of people and to get them to give everything, including their own lives, they just, I don't know. I don't know what is...
Well, but let's be rational for a moment here about this. We're talking about, again, the edge here of Christianity,
right.
Don. I mean...
Right.
This shouldn't give many serious church people any kind of a black eye or anything. It's just the extreme to which people can go in their belief.
No, this group is not emblematic of evangelicals or Christians in general. I'm not implying that in the least. What separates this group from mainstream evangelicals or Catholics is most Christians realize the importance of individual conscience, of using their own conscience to make their moral choices. And that's what went wrong here. The parents who joined this group, they were not evil people. They were not bad people. They were just swept up in what they thought was this liberating movement. They thought that was liberation, not abuse, that they were exposing their children to.
Well, they also gave too much allegiance to this one man.
Yeah, too much faith and too much power. That's the lesson here.
You remember the late, great Margaret Singer.
Yes, yes.
Who was a Berkeley resident and who did a lot of work with children who were involved and young people of all ages as well, involved in cults, particularly with many of the young. But the thing that came home time and time again from her work was, again, this sense of somebody of leadership requiring and demanding absolute loyalty. And absolute loyalty meant really giving up of ego, giving up of self to this figure.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
This is really what Brandt was all about. Brandt Berg. I want to get more calls on. Tom from Los Altos, good morning.
Hi, Michael. I just had a question. If the author had studied whether or not the suicide rate of these children that had been sexually abused in this cult was greater than or equal to other cults or the general population in the United States?
Well, that's a matter of contention, and it's kind of hard to compare these rates. And what the family there have been dozens of suicides in the last 10 years or so among members, children who were raised in this group. Now, and there have been a lot of other cases where, say, drug overdoses. Now, is that a suicide or not? I mean, I would argue that so many of these kids have drug and alcohol problems that that's at least connected in some way to their background. And the family has taken issue with my conclusions about suicide, saying that the rate is not any higher than the general population if you, you know, calculate it such. And I don't know if that's – you can do anything with numbers. The fact is a lot of kids are killing themselves, and it's a tragedy in every case.
Well, what kind of other responses did you have from the family with this book?
Well, I've had one official response from the family, which was a statement that they put out. They actually praised me for all my research and all that, and they disagree with my conclusions, which I understand. The response from the second generation members has been very good. This is a hard book for them to read. It's a hard book for a lot of people to read. People keep telling me I can't stop reading this book, but it's so disturbing at the same time. But I think these kids really want the story to get out, because what frustrates them so much is that justice was never done in this case. The sexual predators in this group were never brought to justice and probably never will be. So all they can do is really get their story out, and that's what they're trying to do. And it is an incredible story.
Well, you certainly helped them do that. How do they regard Berg now, generally?
The ones who left or the ones who are in?
Well, actually, I was thinking about the ones who were in, but...
Oh, they still, you go to their website and look under our founder, and, you know, they acknowledge that he had some, you know, unorthodox ideas back in the crazy 60s, but, you know, God blessed him and is still blessing him and his movement. I mean, they still get revelations from the grave from David Berg.
And we'll go to more of our callers. Kathleen, join us. Good morning.
Good morning. I have so much to say on the subject. I'm sure I won't be able to say everything, but something is better than nothing. I was raised in a fundamentalist Christian family on my father's side, and I'm 50 now. I just went to my father's 80th birthday celebration to get a different view at this family from my maturity, and there were about 150 people in attendance who knew that my father sexually abused me with the same attitude of love. And I didn't say anything at the birthday party, but I requested a private time after his birthday where he confessed that he did sexually abuse me and my sisters. And my confession was facilitated by a pastor of a fundamentalist church who lives and works in Concord at this time. And he's a mandatory reporter. And after this long-awaited confession was made, nothing has still been done. My father is still around children. He's still in a Christian fundamentalist Christian church and surrounded and supported by all of our family members. And I and my children, who are not, who do not support this at all, are ostracized by the rest of our family. And it's extremely painful. And I'd like to know if there's anything else I can do to protect other people in the future, because the pastor of this church in Concord is counseling people who have been sexually abused, and he's not protecting me, his own family. So I wonder how much he's protecting those women.
Sorry that you've gone through all this pain, Kathleen. And Don Latin has certainly done a good deal of research on this sort of on the subject generally. Like
yeah,
you said, Catholics.
Yeah.
And
well, in terms of what kind of help you can get, or both personally and kind of politically, socially, there is several groups, survivors of sexual abuse. One is called SNAP, the Survivors Network of Those Abused by Priests, but they also deal with Protestant churches. So they're a resource to get the word out and counseling groups and things like that. But it's a real issue in the churches. I mean, it's as we've seen in the Catholic Church, and now we're starting to see that a lot is going on in the public schools too, more than maybe we thought. There's been a new wave of reporting and investigation of that. So it's a real problem. What's unique about this story though is that they taught this as doctrine. It wasn't done in private and in secret. So the adults don't even see it as abuse now.
It's a sad story, but it's an extraordinary story. Again, the book by Don Latin is called Jesus Freaks, A True Story of Murder and Madness on the Evangelical Edge. I wish Kathleen good luck, and I thank her for the call. And also, those of you who want to meet Don Latin, you can do so December 5th. He'll be at Books Incorporated in Alameda at 7:30 p.m. Good to see you, and thank you so much for being
thank
with
you,
us.
Michael.
We're going to shift gears. Going to lay off religion for a while and go into the water. Famed photographer Howard Schatz will be joining us for the next half hour. He has put out an extraordinary new collection called H2O, and we'll come to that when we come back to you after a quick break here. You're listening to Forum on KQED Radio. I'm Michael Krasny. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. Internationally acclaimed for his innovative and rich photographic imagery, former Bay Area ophthalmologist and photographer Howard Schatz has published 15 photographic art books, including Water Dance and Pool Light, which, like his new book, HDO, are volumes of underwater photography. His work has appeared in Vogue and GQ, Sports Illustrated, O. He's done covers of Time magazine. He's also had a great deal of work in the fashion and advertising industries, and he joins us for this forum segment. Welcome, Howard Schatz.
Hi, Michael.
Hi.
How you doing?
I'm okay, and a little dazzled by this new book of yours, I must say. Owen Edwards, who writes the introduction, talks about your remarkable relationship with water, and again, an underwater photography extravaganza here of all kinds of ethereal, dazzling, luminous pictures, dreamlike. Why do you keep going under the water?
I'm not done. I keep exploring. It's climbing a creative tree. We sometimes come on branches that are rotten and fall off onto soft place and climb right back on again and occasionally get on a branch where there are many cherries to pick. And when Beverly and I moved to New York 12 years ago, we continued to come back to Marin County to our home and pool to shoot advertising stuff. But I had so many images in my head that I wanted to do that in 2001, we bought a house in Connecticut and spent the next year building a pool that's essentially a photographic studio for shooting under, on, and over the water.
Which you designed, in fact, didn't you?
I designed the pool for photography, so I was able to light it from the top and the bottom and the right and the left and the back and in front or in complicated ways and make the kind of imagery that a regular pool didn't allow. And we spent from 2002 when the pool was built and to 2006 when I finished this H2O project shooting at least once a week, sometimes as many as 4 days a week, in the pool, exploring, discovering, surprising, delighting. And that's how this book came about.
Yeah, I don't know if there's any other pool like this in the world. This is a giant dome to regulate the temperature. You've got studio lights in this pool. Temperature is, what, 92 degrees, so there's no hypothermia?
That's right. That's right. You know, we work all day, and most of the models and dancers we work with don't have, you know, very much body fat. And a pool of 80 degrees or 82, if you're not swimming laps, you get cold very fast. The pool of 85 or 86 or 87, which sounds warm, they begin to shiver after a half an hour, 45 minutes. But a pool that's a little warmer than skin temperature is, you could stay in the pool all day long, feel absolutely comfortable, and it allowed us not to have to stop working, to keep going. And the other things about the pool, the chemistry is such that if somebody opens their eyes, it's like tears. The clarity is super clarity. We're dealing with the problem of turbidity underwater, cloudiness.
No chlorine.
We take the chlorine out of the water the morning of the shoot. And a pool can do without chlorine for a day. And then we replace it when we're done shooting. So we're able to do that. So the models are able to be themselves underwater. Of course, these are models that I've casted. I've probably casted 1,000 models and maybe that many dancers. And not everybody can do this work. Go under, keep a normal, natural face, and act or behave or perform as if they're not underwater. And we go through casting to look for those kind of people to do that. And we found a number, more than a handful, but not more than 24 people who could really... were really brilliant underwater.
These are models who are really, in their own vein, artists, aren't they?
Well, yeah, and we collaborate. One thing about shooting in a studio, you could make a photograph and then you say to the model, move your head, turn your this way, look that way, move this way, to do this with your arms. But when you're underwater, there's not much way you can communicate. We had little ways of communicating. I could make sounds to get them to do one thing or another, but it wasn't complicated. So I needed models that were physically creative, that understood what the idea was, the fantasy, the dream, and were able to artistically express those things.
Talking with photographer Howard Schatz, who has a new book out called H2O. And by the way, if you'd like to join us in this segment, you are welcome to do so. Our toll-free number is 866-733-6786. I know there are many fans of Howard Schatz's work and many who are interested in the whole, well, science of photography, plus, in his case, photography that's done literally underwater. Our email address here is forum@kqed.org. And this is photography which is really all about motion.
In a way, it is. The underwater environment is a weightless one. We started long ago with Katita Waldo, who's now a prima ballerina in the San Francisco Ballet, and I had photographed her for another project, a project on redheads, of which she's on the cover. And when I sort of learned how to make underwater photographs, I called her up and I said, "Katita, can you swim?" She says, "Well, certainly I can." And she came over, and we both learned quickly and discovered that, you know, the adversary of dancers is gravity. When they jump in the air, they come down. Gravity brings them down. So they're up in the air for a second or a fraction of a second. Whereas underwater, they blow out a little bit of air, become evenly buoyant, not light and floating up and not too heavy and going down, but evenly buoyant with the water. And it's as if they're making a leap that could last as long as they can hold their breath, whether it's 30 seconds or a minute and a half. And it was a marvelous thing to see and do. And in fact, in terms of movement, a number of people have asked us to make films, videos, commercials for television of dance movement and other kinds of movement underwater because of this slow motion, beautiful, ethereal movement of the body.
Yeah, I was struck by the fact that you're all holding your breath under there. Nobody's got a snorkel or anything like that.
No, we hold our breath. Most people can learn to hold their breath a minute or more, most people. I mean, with a lot of practice, most people probably can hold their breath 2 or 3 minutes. So it isn't too much of a challenge to hold your breath. The main thing for most people is being comfortable doing so. The second thing is the kind of movement. For example, there's a photograph in the book near the end of Amanda Cobb, who's a ballerina with the ABT here in New York. And what I wanted to do was produce a picture. Imagine a dancer in a beautiful dress standing on a pedestal on one foot, on her tiptoe, on point, and holding a beautiful dance pose with a strong wind machine blowing from her front back. So her hair is pulled back and her dress is pulled back, and it looks like she's in the wind. Now, how would one do that underwater? Swimming underwater, being underwater and moving, it's a little bit dorky to photograph that. It's not pretty. It doesn't look so great. So what we did was we put she was in a flesh-colored leotard, and we put ribbons around her that were 10, 15 feet long, and they sort of just dragged down. And we put a band around her waist, and with a black cord, a long black cord, and an assistant underwater 20 feet away, I had the assistant pull her across the frame of the camera slowly. And as he pulled her, her hair pulled back, the ribbons pulled back, and it looked like she was flying through the water. And, you know, we did many of these tricks sort of things to maximize these beautiful poses, to make things that look like movement.
Talking with Howard Schatz, whose new book is H2O. We've been talking a good deal this morning about religion. Where'd you get this idea of a Last Supper?
Well, there are a number of images in the book where I borrowed from well-known works of art. And one was Da Vinci's Last Supper. And mostly it was the challenge of making an image with 13 people underwater that look like the Last Supper. And I thought about it and dreamed, and I got, you know, obsessed with it, fixed on it. And it took months and months to prepare. We had the costumes made, gloves, bustiers, hats from a milliner. I had a makeup artist make many kinds of makeup till I found it just right. I found all the right people. I got the set. It was all about underwater, where water meets air, it's reflective. It's a reflectant. One reason your eyes have this little light glow is that there's a layer of fluid on your cornea, and the light hits that layer of fluid, and it's a reflectant. when you get out of the shower in the bathroom, you can see you're wet because the droplets, their surface where air and water meet becomes reflected and reflecting the lights in the bathroom. So this became something about reflective. There's a ceiling of the water, where the water surface and air meet. So the undersurface of the water is reflected. I use silver everywhere. I use black and white unitards with graphic designs, with the only color being red, because this is mostly about betrayal. And, you know, to make a piece that works like this, it took lots and lots of thought, lots and lots of detail, I got a lot of help, and we were able to do it.
Talk about a piece like this, or for that matter, any of the photographs in this collection, and this is something that I think listeners will want to weigh in on. You talk about the difference between, and this is true not only in photography, it's probably true in all the arts, but the difference between a good photograph and an incredible photograph. And it seems as if even with all the preparation that you can do, you don't necessarily move from good to incredible unless something maybe crazy takes place, or you take a chance, or something simply happens out of the ordinary that you hadn't expected. It's a different part of the equation, isn't it?
It is. I think that any time you make something up, whether one is writing a poem or a short story or a book or an editorial or making a drawing or making a sketch or making a sculpture or building something, one could be a fine technician, know what they're doing, and usually do whatever they're doing, creating, do it well. But to make it fantastic, to make it magnificent and spectacular and where it takes your breath away and lets the hair in the back of your neck stand up, that's a very, very tough, difficult, elusive thing to achieve. And one thing you have to do is you have to pay attention to everything and really think about it and really work at it. And then, of course, sometimes it's luck. Something happens that you didn't expect, you didn't even think of, that a bunch of things come together and fall together, and you have something magic, and you have really a great creative work of art.
So how often do you think, especially being self-scrutinizing, that you manage to achieve this?
Well, you know, I don't know. That's for others to say. I can say in this book there are 100 images or 120. I made 150,000 frames. I edited those 150,000 frames down to 1,000 frames. I spent 4 years working at this and looking at it, and I edited again down to 300 frames. And then I used five photo editors, known, talented, experienced, respected photo editors, to edit these 300 frames. I asked them all to give each picture a rating of A, it's got to be and it's great, B, it's very good, it probably should be in the book, C, I'm not so sure, D, not so good, no, I don't think so, E, no way. And it turns out, of the 300 frames, 100 images got one of every one of those letters. In other words, A, B, C, D, and E. 100 images where experienced photo editors, one thought it was fantastic, another said, don't ever put this in the book. Another 100 images got some good, some bad, and the 100 images in the book all got 4 out of 5, at least, A's and B's. So I let these photo editors help me judge this final edit, and whether any of these images will last, you know, the way a Mona Lisa lasts, who knows? Only time will tell.
Talking again with Howard Schatz. His new book is H2O. Actually, I'd like to put it out to listeners in the time we have remaining. How do you make that judgment? I mean, many people who listen to us are involved in the arts and are listening to us while they're creating. Or those of you who are critical of the arts or perceive the arts, how do you make that distinction between something that is good, that shows a great deal of thoughtfulness and work and imagination, maybe even visionary qualities, and something that just really deserves a much more superlative adjective, like incredible or great? It's always a question that sort of intrigues me, and if some of you have some thoughts, I'd like to hear from you. Again, the toll-free number to reach us at, whether it's listening on Internet or radio or Sirius satellite, is 866-733-6786, and you can send us an email as well. The email address is forum@kqed.org, and with all the time and with all the work that you've put in and the photo editors and what you've just described for us, the meticulous detail that goes into deciding these images, What do you hope people will derive?
I photograph to surprise and delight myself. I'm blessed, lucky, grateful that a publisher would want to publish this work. So I've derived my biggest happiness, really. Making these images was a happiness, was every day a surprise, a delight. Oh, occasionally there were disappointments, but mostly the joy was in the journey for me. And I feel I've accomplished what I want to accomplish. I mean, there are many other things that I want to do. I have many other ideas, and I hope I'll live a long time to explore some of them. But I believe I've achieved what I want to achieve. And it's great if others find this as, you know, magnificent and wonderful and terrific. That would be great for me. I would like that very much. Who wouldn't?
But I think you're suggesting maybe it's more for you than it is for those who perceive the images. Huh?
Well, initially I did it for me.
Yeah.
I did it for me. I mean, it has to be for me. If it's for somebody else, there isn't the same sort of passionate force to make something magic. It just, you know, I can be a really good technician. And make when we do advertising, an art director will ask me to do a certain kind of image. And I sort of put on my compulsive cap as a technician, a creative technician, and make the image that he or she has in mind and make it perfectly and exactly and beautifully, then hopefully there's time enough in the day that we're shooting that I can make go beyond that and make something for which I also might have a passion. But it has to come from inside.
Let me bring our callers in. We go first to Boston, Massachusetts. Mike, you're on. Good morning.
Yes, good morning. I'm a collector of engraving, mostly high-end custom-made knives. And what I look at in the art, particularly the engraving piece, is really the technical execution and the relationship I have with the artist, how much they seem to care about their end product. That's what's so important to me. And I find that the rest of it is all going to fall in if those things are there.
Yeah, it's fascinating, again, to just hear the criteria like that. And thank you, Mike, for letting us know. I'm going to go to another caller here. And
Let me comment just for a second,
please.
Michael, on that. I think that was excellent. I think technically, you know, if somebody writes a book and the commas are in the wrong place and the sentence structure stinks, the idea of the book could be great. The story could be very interesting. But if it's not, you know, done really well and there are mistakes in there, it's so distracting and so much ruins and dilutes the impact of the main thing. So I think pieces of art ought to technically be exactly what the artist has in mind, and he should be very careful to make something excellent. Also, collectors often like to have relationship with artists. It sometimes brings the piece of art and brings more meaning for the collector.
Owen, you're on. Good morning.
Yes, good morning. I can say good morning, Maestro, because that addresses you both. This is probably the most unobjective call that you'll have all day. I've been lucky to work with Howard for many, many years now, and I work with him as a writer and a longtime observer of photography. But I just want to say one unabashed, worshipful comment, which is that I've had the good luck to work with Irving Penn and Richard Avedon, and just finished helping out on a book by the great 96-year-old architectural photographer Julia Shulman. But I just want to say that Howie belongs right up there with those greats, and he's the perfect mix of science and art. He gets, as he has pointed out, he gets the details right, but if it weren't for the fact that he has a phenomenal eye for beauty, and I think H2O, despite the fact that I've been involved with it, I can objectively say that H2O is probably one of the most beautiful books of photography that has ever been published. And if Howie hadn't already done a book by the time I met him, I would claim that I discovered him. But I may just say that anyway. So congratulations, Howard. This is great work, and I look forward to seeing more and more over the years.
Thank you for the call. Good to hear from
Mike,
you this morning. Howard Chow.
I don't know if we have to go on after that.
We will. Okay. Tamsin is waiting to talk to us from Santa Barbara. Morning, Tamsin.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. I'm a first-time caller. I love the show. I wanted to make the point in response to the question about what makes something superlative rather than just really good. And it seems to me, I'm a musician rather than an artist, but it's an emotional connection that you have with a piece of work. And the fact that you can reach so many people makes something truly spectacular and brings you back to it again and again and again. And I think, you know, that's really, for me, what connects me with a piece of art.
That emotional connectedness, you mean, yeah.
Yeah, the connection, it's not quantifiable, which makes it so hard. But if you can reach so many people, the artists that your guest was referring to that all agreed, you know, that must be an emotional thing that they're responding to, because the professional experience they have doesn't get it.
Yeah, but, you know, there are people who certainly don't qualify as great artists who reach a lot of people.
I mean,
if you're going to use democracy and numbers as a standard of judgment or the touchstone to greatness, you might run into a problem, because there's a lot of schlock out there that reaches a lot of people. It's this whole thing about judgment and how we decide what is great is aesthetically and so forth is a pretty formidable question, a very difficult question.
One other thing about doing that, I think in a way the final judge is time. I've said many times in talking to other photographers and students, that time is the best editor. When one does a piece of art, when one does photography, one looks at the images and remembers the shoot, remembers their relationship with whatever they were shooting, and can't really see quite clearly what the image is doing. But if they put it away and look at it later, it's the same thing with writing. You can write a paragraph you think is great, and you read it a week later, and you may find, oh, God, this needs help. And it's the test of time that is, in a way, the final judge. But I would agree with her statement that something that comes out that's superlative, that was her first word on it. I do think that in order for one individual to make something that is superlative and stands the test of time and remains superlative, I think it has to come from something emotional, passionate, from way down deep inside. There are a number of people come up with ideas for me. Hey, how about this? Or you ought to shoot this, or you ought to shoot this. Well, I can hear these ideas, and objectively and logically, oh, that sounds like a pretty good idea. But no one has come up with an idea where down deep inside it touches me, because most of the time it has to come from the inside. So I usually say, go ahead and do it. It sounds like a great idea.
Well, here's Caroline, who sends the following email. Spectacular art is different from what's been done, and in many cases dramatic. It's luck that puts things together in such a way that strikes people as attractive, not also beautiful, but attractive. A couple of questions before we get another caller or two in here. This is Jay, who says, I just Googled Mr. Schatz's work, and it's really beautiful. Didn't one of the Westons use a pool to make photos back in the day?
Yeah, Weston did. But he shot through glass, and he used a large camera. And his pictures are in black and white. The light comes from above, and they're very spectacular. And his work, Brett Weston's work, was inspirational for me when I started out on this 12, 13 years ago.
Gary asks, where can one buy prints of your work?
Well, they can go to our website and look under galleries, and there are galleries all over the country that represent us and sell our fine art prints.
And the website is?
HowardSchatz.com.
And it's S-C-H-A-T-Z.
S-C-H-A-T-Z.
And Tom is next. Tom, you're on.
Hey, great show, Mike, and thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
Yeah, Mr. Schatz, when you were talking about the model with the banners, I mean, pulled through the water and the nice flowing motion of the model's hair and banners and all, I'd just been watching the news of the oil spill, the overhead shots, I guess some choppers of the yellow barriers being put out around the beaches of the bay. I think most people would agree that the bay is our most beautiful model here, especially the actual Golden Gate, and, you know, the obedience of land and sea that, you know, Ansel Adams made famous and Big Sur and so on. But I was wondering, do you think a great photographer such as yourself could actually make some kind of montage, a gigantic composite photograph of the entire barrier? You know, they would have the image resolution to actually see individual birds and, you know, even down to, you know, fish and other, you know, individual wavelets and, you know, the shimmering that you talked about, too, with the surface, you know, with water and air, or oil and water and air meet. I think the photographers were aware of the beauty when they were, you know, doing it this morning on the news, the news photographers, but there wasn't a whole or a final presentation. I think someone like you might be able to do that.
Well, you put out a nice challenge, but already he said it has to come from within him.
That's exactly right.
Yeah, just rent a chopper or go up to a high point and look down on the, it's very abstract, you know, just a beautiful yellow line, you know, around the Bay Bridge and the surrounding beaches. I think it's...
Well, you probably can rent a helicopter for about $150 an hour. You probably can rent a really good medium format camera with a low ISO and great resolution for another $200-$300 an hour. You might have to get a gyroscope to reduce the vibrations, and I'll bet you can make a spectacular picture.
Go out and shoot those photographs, Tom.
That's right.
Thank you for the call, and I want to get one other caller on here. It's Plato from, not Greece, no, Alamo, California. Hi.
Hi, Michael. Let me turn this radio down.
Yeah, you got to turn the radio down here. Otherwise, it's going to reverberate. And
at the book signing?
Oh, you were the Plato I met last night. Yeah,
that's right.
And, at a book signing.
And
right.
Howie Schatz has been a friend of mine for a long time, and I lost track of him when he left. And I just feel so fortunate to find him again. I admired all the pictures underwater they did, and I'm delighted that he's had such a great career in this. It just kind of blows my mind, and it's just thrilling to hear that he's
reached the top of the mountain in the world of photography.
Thank you very much, Plato. You had a book signing for your book, Michael, last night?
Last night here at KQED, we did.
There
yes.
you go.
And you going to be appearing here in the Bay Area in the next year or so, or are you going to stay over there in New York?
Well, I hope we can come back to see the friends I love and the beautiful land that's San Francisco Bay Area that we love so much.
Well, there's beautiful pictures to be seen in this new book. Again, it's H2O by internationally acclaimed photographer Howard Schatz. And thank you so much for being with us, Howard.
Thanks, Michael. Appreciate it very much.
Appreciate you being with us. We're here with you Monday through Friday, 9 to 11, and the second hour, or one of the hours, I should say, is repeated in the 10 o'clock p.m. Want to remind you that tomorrow we're recording a program for future broadcasts. It's an interview with Charles Schulz biographer David McKellis. Although we cannot have live calls, we still welcome your participation. Send your suggested questions for us to ask David McKellis to forum@kqed.org or call our listener caller line at 415-553-3300. Thanks to all of you. I'm Michael Krasny.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Claude and Louise Rosenberg Jr. Family Foundation.